Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. Over the last year, numerous protests have erupted around Confederate memorials throughout the South. Here in New Mexico, we've also grappled with a history of colonialism and racism. That has played out at the annual Entrada during Santa Fe's Fiesta, and at the University of New Mexico, there have also been protests and calls for change around the university's official seal, as well as murals created in the 1930s in the Zimmerman Library. The Three Peoples murals have been criticized for decades for what people have called racist and inaccurate depictions. A new class created this semester offers students in-depth context for these murals and the controversy, with the goal of students drafting recommendations for possible changes to the administration. So today I am joined by Professor Kimberly Pinder, Dean of the College of Fine Arts and an art history professor, Alex Lubin, American Studies professor and also an interim associate provost for faculty development. They are leading the class. Also joining us is Kevin Brown, program specialist in the Indigenous Nations Library Program at UNM. And we have Jacob Lorenzen, an undergraduate student who's enrolled in the class. But Professor Pinder, let me start with you. I'll put the images of the murals on our website at KUNM.org, but can you give us some brief context of what these murals were supposed to represent when they're created, what they look like?
Right. So we have learned quite a bit about this history in the class, that they were commissioned by President Zimmerman and by the artist Kenneth Adams. The theme is based on the idea of the tricultural population here in New Mexico. They date from 1939, which is very significant that we're learning in the class because of so much was going on here in the state, on the university campus, as well as in the world when you think of that year. And they depict representations basically as stereotypes of these three cultures, indigenous, Hispanic, and Anglo. And then at the very end, there is this attempt in the mural to show that these cultures have come together in unity.
Kevin, you are on the library staff, and you're one of the people who sent a letter to the Dean of Libraries about these murals. Can you explain to us why you and your fellow librarians have found them offensive and felt this was a hostile work environment?
To be frank, we were inspired by the movement of, at the time, Kiva Club.
This is the student Native American club.
Mm-hmm. It was founded in the 1950s, and they have a long history of activism and advocacy. In 2016, they were going through the UNM seal process of withdrawing the official UNM seal that had similar connotations of colonialism. Myself and a small group of library colleagues, we understood the fact that students are petitioning for withdrawal of this UNM seal, and we felt inspired to take up another issue that was problematic, and that was in the Zimmerman Library, the Adams murals. We felt it was a hostile work environment because, one, we had to acknowledge them in our space, in our workspace. I, myself, give formal tours to visiting scholars, visiting school groups, predominantly who are Native American school groups. And I have to acknowledge those murals in my tours. I have to acknowledge the history behind them, and I have to acknowledge the representation of them as Native people. And then two, as a public institution, several students have come to me and said they don't like studying where those murals are located because it makes them uncomfortable and they don't depict appropriate subject matter for them. And it creates a hostile learning environment. So several of our colleagues in 2016 formally submitted our letter pertaining to the Adams murals on November 2nd, 2016, to our college dean. And then it was submitted to OEO and the Provost and Academic Affairs Office.
That's the Office of Equal Opportunity?
Yes, okay. Office of Equal Opportunity. They themselves determined that it did not fit the criteria of a hostile work environment, so they declined to become more involved in that. And then it was a provost and academic matter after that.
Professor Alex Lubin, talk about the creation of the class and the context of all that.
Yeah, so when I entered the Academic Affairs Office as the interim associate provost, I transitioned from being the chair of American Studies, the American Studies Department, where coincidentally I had taught courses on race in America, in which I asked students to use the murals actually as an object lesson and as something they should write about. But when I entered the provost's office this fall, I was approached by the dean of the library, who raised the news about the staff and faculty of the library protest letter. My response to that was to talk with people in the office and also recognize that there had been letters sent to the provost's office from people in the library and out who said, oh, no, we're fine with it. There was another side to it as well. Mm-hmm. And without conveying what my own opinion is on this, I thought it would be a good idea, following debate last year about the official seal, if we gave students a voice in what should happen, and that we could make it, again, the murals, something that we could learn something about. How do you deal with problematic public art? This came on the heels, of course, of debates about monuments in Charlottesville, Virginia, as well as debates around the country about, and at universities, about public art. And so I asked Professor Pinder, who studies murals and has taught several mural classes, to team up, and along with a task force that was formed of people in the library and across the university who study public art, Chicano history, Native and Indigenous history, to design a course that could help students figure out possible solutions.
Professor Kimberly Pinder, what is the structure of the class?
Well, as Alex just mentioned, it was very collaborative with the committee. So the committee that he formed that still is moving forward with their own ways of redress for this topic have been contributing lectures that are relevant to all the different topics that really open out when you start looking at the mural as representing a moment in time that also reflects so much about New Mexico history, United States history, global history. And so every Monday and Wednesday, we have different people coming in and talking about different topics. And we have 32 guest lectures. And then the students have various types of assignments that they've been doing throughout the semester that are getting them to look at the mural and the period of 1939 in different ways. And then they've been broken up into assigned to 10 different groups that were created based on their profiles about their interest and what majors they are. So they're interdisciplinary groups. And then those groups are supposed to come up with proposals. And those proposals will then be a part of their final projects, but also part of how the class will then present using all of this wonderful input from students as they're gaining all this knowledge from the course to then present to the provost and the president.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about the Three Peoples murals in Zimmerman Library. They've sparked protests periodically since they were created in 1939. A new class this semester focuses on the murals, and students will create recommendations on what should happen to them. We're talking with Professors Alex Lubin and Kimberly Pinder, who are teaching the class, and Kevin Brown with the Indigenous Nations Library Program. Also here is Senior Jacob Lorenzen. He's one of the students in the class. Were you aware of the murals before you took the class?
I was not. Actually, I was not aware of them until Professor Lubin told us about the class. And then I went and saw the murals, and they were off, to say the least. If you're looking at it from left to right, you have a Native American setting with all of these indigenous people working on handicrafts and kind of these two men standing in the background in a kind of spiritual way. And then moving on to the next one, you have Mexican-Americans and Hispanic people working plows and working walls. And then you move on to the Anglo part of the mural, and it's all of the sciences. And that seems very off to me.
What kind of things have you learned about New Mexico history or art or other issues?
A lot. just on Monday, we had Dr. Kathy Powers come in and talk to us about all of the things that go into restorative justice. I always thought that restorative justice just meant a payout in money so to fund people who have been wronged by the government or by different peoples. And I didn't really understand that that might not be what they want as a restoration for all the impact that those things have had in their lives. And then today we had people coming in talking about the history of murals in America and what goes into painting them and what kind of effect that they have on the community. And I think that's really interesting.
Kevin, I know that you were among the first people to do a guest lecture, right?
Yeah.
In the class?
Yes.
We kicked it off.
We kicked off the lecture.
What was the context you gave for this, starting this whole thing?
So the context we gave was surrounding the letter. It was a public portion of the letter. We didn't want to submit the entire full document with the signatories on the letter because we were afraid of the retaliation. And myself and my colleague, Samuel Cisneros, who's a manuscript archivist in the Center for Southwest Research, we provided our context for the letter, but also the context for moving this process from an official UNM standpoint, because throughout the entire class, there's the history of student activism and community activism towards the murals. We discussed several options prior to writing the letter. One was installing a plaque that we oppose the messaging of the murals. And that evolved into a formal decree that the mural should be taken down and be removed with something, be replaced with something of cultural and also contemporary significance to UNM. Because this mural is in a public space, but it's also a public reminder of the 1930s agenda, setting cultures and civilizations in stages and progressions. Primitive or savage is the lowest tier, and that's usually indigenous, analogous to indigenous peoples and communities. And then you have the advanced civilizations, which is a ethnocentric or Eurocentric perspective of looking at Western European nations as the final step in civilization. And then when we formally written the letter, we wanted the murals taken down again, but we didn't want it to be used as an educational tool. Now, my feelings of this has evolved over time. I do think it can be used as an educational component, but in a proper setting, not in a public venue like the library, but in a museum that can be contextualized, can be taught, and can be discussed in a control setting rather than a public place where you walk in and you see it.
So. Professor Alex Lubin, I wanted to ask, you're also working with a task force?
Correct. So okay. Last fall, the interim provost, Craig White, asked me to convene a task force. It was open to really anybody who I thought had expertise to contribute or experiences to contribute, and its object primarily was not only to talk about a process, but also to think about what do students need to know, what knowledge do they need to have to make informed decisions about how to transform the murals or the space or take them down or do something else, right? And so many of the participants in the task force have been the experts speaking to the class. And I should also mention that the charge of the planning committee, its membership, the minutes from the meetings, the syllabus for the class, every lecture in the class is posted on my website in the provost office.
I will put a link to that on our website.
And every single one of our classes, although we're almost halfway done, are open to the public.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Professor Pinder, this is also we're in a state institution. Mm-hmm. So what is the context of that in terms of the role of this institution and other institutions?
I was really interested in making sure the students kind of knew what was at stake here. So now they actually know what they're up against and how you have to write letters to explain why things need to be changed. And that will be a part of their proposals if those proposals elect for some kind of change. I mean, I expect that some students, maybe a group, will say that they don't need to be changed. Another thing I wanted to mention about protests. So we actually have had a couple of speakers, alumni, come back and talk about when they protested these murals 20 years ago, 30 years ago. This is another part of of wanting change, you know, that someone has to protest for there to be some kind of change. And it can be done in many different ways, like out on the streets, holding up signs. The murals have been vandalized twice because of the content, directly throwing paint onto them. That's another way, another avenue. I would definitely be confident in saying that this class is an avenue. Alex, working from his position in the provost office, is doing his way of making protests. Of course, the letter was. So I think it's really, for me, it's really exciting to see that aspect of the pedagogical mission of the class being kind of a sort of background theme that is another set of skills maybe that we're exposing the students to. So I'd love to hear what Jacob thinks about that in terms of how he's now thinking about what protest can be.
I don't think you're necessarily teaching us protest techniques to go out and protest different parts of the university. I never really think of protest as anything more than the large crowds of people with signs or yelling things. But I realize that that's not really all that protest can be.
Mm-hmm. Does any one voice have more weight, or should it have more weight?
It's a really great question. I think of universities, as particularly public universities, as places that belong to students, staff, faculty, the community around it. This class is one avenue to give students, and to some extent community staff and faculty around campus, a way to participate. It is not a statewide discussion, and it's not even a citywide discussion. This is a discussion, particularly at UNM, about how UNM seeks to represent who we are. I think that there will be avenues at the end of the semester for people on the planning committee, people from the library, to also restate their proposal, either to take it down, whatever it is, and that should be valued and centered in the discussion as well.
In general, public art addresses multiple audiences. And a university also has multiple audiences and people who are part of the campus in different ways, and that the students need to understand that. Faculty need to understand, the administration needs to understand that it's a hostile work environment because Kevin and his colleagues live with that mural every single day. And I'm kind of going off a little bit, but what I mean is in terms of we're learning about priorities and what's privileged on a campus, in a state, in a country. What is the priority here? Preserving something from 1939 that definitely has its historic merits, or a lived, current, contemporary human experience that is happening every single day? These are huge questions, you know, not necessarily about historic preservation, but the role in which history and who considers its importance and whose history's importance really frames how we live our lives on a daily basis.
One of the questions, or one of the thoughts that keep coming up for me as I hear experts talk about historic preservation, is why is 1939 the moment at which we freeze the past? Why doesn't it go back deeper? On whose land is Zimmerman Library built? Why isn't that part of the record? Right? Why isn't that something that gets represented? The current protest is part of centuries of protests about wanting to conceal a past that, for people who are living today, is not over, right? Is not closed. You know, for those who say nothing can change, why are you changing the past? It's the murals that are changing the past. The murals are suggesting that the development of the United States and Anglo presence in this area is when history began, and not with any of the indigenous peoples or Hispanic people who were here and preceded that.
So for us as indigenous people, but also as faculty, as librarians who work in that library, we would like to see something that's relevant to the moment and in the moment. And I suggested, you know, to the group in my presentation, of having a technological component where artists, community members, you know, faculty can submit things to display on those little four niche areas in the library and the West Wing area. So it can change with the times. For me, there's nothing important about those murals because there's no historical significance with those murals to me. through the historical preservation nomination process, those murals were constantly brought up as essential characteristics of the library. For me, I saw, you know, the woodwork in the West Wing is totally beautiful, and craftsmanship on that is, for me, it's much more intimate than, say, those canvases. And for me, that building has a character of those, the craftsmanship of the woodworkers and then the design much more than the murals do. So for me, I would like to see a more dynamic process of recognizing UNM's, you know, progress through time.
Who's the ultimate arbiter in terms of what happens?
Mm-hmm. A remedy like the one that Kevin just suggested may not need to go through several layers of bureaucracy,
right. Mm-hmm.
Because it's not actually taking them down, or maybe it's even mm-hmm. concealing them but leaving them there. What historic preservationists, I think, want to see is that future generations can decide in 100 years, mm-hmm. where are those murals? We want them, mm-hmm. and can reveal them if that's what those people mm-hmm. want. To do something that either recontextualizes or conceals is something that has to go through the Board of Regents Historic Preservation mm-hmm. Office, maybe the State Historic Preservation Office, and we need to get a determination whether these changes represent what are called an adverse effect on the art.
Mm-hmm. On the building, too.
On the building, like, and on the building.
Thought of as a piece right. for the Jean Gamin building.
See, I mean, if you like physically took them down,
right?
That may be a bigger process that would require the State Historic Preservation Office mm-hmm. communicating with a federal office as well. Again, not to say it's impossible, but the path forward depends on what the remedy is. I imagine that the president will ultimately make a decision about which proposal to try to advance through the Regents and the Regents Historic Preservation Committee.
Can I just jump in here about, mm-hmm. again, who's privileged here? There seems to be so much interest in deciding and determining who's going to make this decision. And I always like to point out is that whoever's making that decision, who really are the stakeholders here? You know, because if most of the students on campus have no idea they exist, and let's expand that now to most of the people in Albuquerque have never seen them, and then most of the people in the state of New Mexico. But then we're talking about how the Registry of Historic Places are going to have like a huge input on mm-hmm. whether these can be amended or removed. I think that's another really important conundrum that we're into here.
The process has been extremely political throughout the history of the murals. Mm-hmm. I mean, the nomination process.
The nomination process to get the artist.
To get the artist
was mm-hmm. very political from mm-hmm. his own perspective of portraying New Mexico peoples in that fashion. And then, two, the nomination process for the historic preservation of the building and the murals was very political as well, because the documents don't disclose the actual history of activism or protests on those murals. So
when was it nominated for that status?
2010.
But that's quite recent.
But it took several years of research and several years of developing a narrative. And that narrative made activism protests those murals non-important to the history of those murals. Mm-hmm. So even that in itself was, you know, politicized too.
Well, I really appreciate you all coming and talking about this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you just joined us on KUNM, this is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. We just heard from Kevin Brown, Program Specialist with the Indigenous Nations Library Program at UNM, Alex Lubin, Political Science Professor and Interim Associate Provost for Faculty Development, and Kimberly Pinder, Dean of the College of Fine Arts, as well as student Jacob Lorenzen. Find photos of the murals and links to resources discussed here, including videos of classes on the murals, at KUNM.org. Now we go to our segment where we highlight research being done by students and faculty at UNM that you might not have heard about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adam Smith, Spoken Word Hour host. Today I've invited into the studio Dr. Christina Jacobson, author of the book The Sound of Navajo Country, Music, Language, and Dene Belonging. Thanks so much for coming in. I wanted to ask you about an anecdote that came up in your book that relates to this theme that you return to again and again, which was on the intergenerational politics of music and language. Could you tell us that black sheep anecdote from the introductory chapter?
Sure. So there's a young girl attending elementary school in the heart of Navajo Nation in the community of Many Farms. And she has a Diné or Navajo mother and a Korean and French father. And so her surname is not a typical last name. And so she has this one male classmate who keeps on teasing her about her last name and then uses that by extension to sort of make her feel like she doesn't belong because she has a lighter skin tone and these sorts of things. So she goes home to her maternal grandmother. She's really upset. And they kind of put their heads together mm-hmm. about what kind of comeback she could have or how she can troubleshoot this particular issue she's having. And so the grandmother suggests, her masana, that she come back with a Navajo word that he's not going to understand. And mm-hmm. so she translates his last name, which is black sheep, into Navajo, which is Tepetlejine. And teaches her granddaughter how to pronounce this word. And then she goes back to school the next day. And she says, when he teases her again, and she says, oh, yeah, well, de Bethlehem. And then she goes, bah. And so it does like a, you know, imitating a sheep sound. And he doesn't understand what she's saying. And he feels himself pretty disenfranchised, which is exactly how he had been making her feel. And it sort of levels the playing field in that way. And so then she ends, in the book I talk about the way she sort of ends that story that she told to me. She was around 9 when that happened. And she goes, and Chris, addressing me, he's a full blood too. And so this idea of an expectation that the higher one's percentage of Native or Navajo blood, in this case, the more fluent one will be as a Diné speaker, is sort of exemplified in this particular example. So the other thing about this anecdote is that this young girl, Ashley, cannot stand country music. And this is another key thematic in the book, is who listens to country, who plays country, who likes it, and who, conversely, is completely disidentified with it. And so what I talk about is the intergenerational politics of sound and of belonging is also exemplified by people's taste in music and in country in particular on the reservation, so that folks that are, say, 45 and older oftentimes are huge fans and play country music and love it, and those that are younger may not listen to it at all, such as this example with Ashley.
What do you see as the connection between songwriting and ethnography?
They're both narrative-based art forms. And the job of a good song and the job of a good ethnography that is accessibly written is to humanize our interlocutors, is to humanize the people that we're writing about, talking about, singing about, and almost always through really, really close use and attention to the senses. And that's typically how we bring people into a story, really one at a time, right? One individual at a time. And then if we can get someone to latch on to one individual or care about that individual, by extension, oftentimes we will come to care for a community that we may have otherwise not known about or not thought that we ever cared about.
And so these days you're teaching a class in songwriting here at UNM?
Yeah, I teach a class on songwriting in the fall at UNM. And then this semester I'm teaching a class called the Anthropology of Music and Sound, where we read 4 ethnographies and talk about a lot of these thematics.
That's really great. Thank you so much for coming in today, Christina.
Thanks for the invite.
That was Marty Adam-Smith talking to Christina Jacobson, author of The Sound of Navajo Country. Find this episode and all our past episodes of University Showcase at kunm.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.